continue a topic we began yesterday, Christians in the Middle East. We conducted somewhat of a survey yesterday of the Christians in the Middle East, and although I don't think I summed up that survey for you as to the total number of Christians in the Middle East, I should do that today. Excuse the spectrum, the high and the low estimate. It's somewhere between 12 and 17 million. I suppose the statistics that I did give there, if we added them up, would perhaps even be a little less than 12 million, but it's simply not possible to be more exact. Egypt and Lebanon are the countries with the most Christians. Cyprus is the country of the Middle East with the highest percentage of Christians. Lebanon being the only other country where the Christians are a sizable minority, and they were at one time on an equal basis with followers of the Islamic religion in Lebanon, but through attrition and the exodus, attrition through the exodus of Christians, they are no longer either in the majority or on a par. But numbers don't tell the story. Numbers really do not lead us where we want to go. I think the surprising thing is that there are as many Christians in the Middle East as there are. That's perhaps a surprise for you to discover. I'd like to raise three questions today, and I really want to involve all of us in finding answers to these questions. And I'm going to give all three of them at the beginning, and then we'll come back and begin with number one. The first question: how are Eastern Christians coping today in the strongly Islamic culture of the Middle East lands? How are Eastern Christians coping today in the strongly Islamic culture of the Middle East lands? I have given some clues to that during this week and have begun to shape an answer, but I think we should come back to this question and attempt a more definitive answer. The second question: what are the prospects for peace and reconciliation in the Middle East? What are the prospects for peace and reconciliation in the Middle East? The third question: where do we, that is, Western Christians and citizens of Western nations, fit in the Middle East mosaic? Where do we, Western Christians and citizens of Western nations, fit in the Middle East mosaic? So, these are the three questions we'd like to look at in greater detail. Back to the first question. How are Eastern Christians coping today in the strongly Islamic culture of the Middle East lands? What do you remember from some of our comments and some of our conversation? They're moving out. That would be then an answer in the negative. They're not faring very well. They're not coping very well. There certainly is that aspect. And that answer to this question, and I have some other negative answers I think we should consider. Why are they moving out? What do you remember? What's one of the reasons for this exodus? They're the ones who pay. That's what I said. Okay, that's what they told me. They are the ones that pay the price, or it's at their expense that a lot of the things happen in the Middle East that happen, whether it be peace movement or political maneuver, or whether it be a resurgence, a revitalization of Islam as a religion. The Christians in the Middle East most often are the most directly affected and suffer pressures which make it uncomfortable and lift their eyes to a different place in the world where they might have a different life. Now that is true of the Palestinians, I suppose, more than any other group. Among the Palestinians, the Anglican Church and the Lutheran Church have congregations, and these two churches have been close together throughout the centuries. They are trying to get closer together as time goes along, but it's not easy. I did visit the Anglican bishop in Amman, Jordan, in 1980, and Assisting Bishop Khoury told of the tragic consequences of this exodus, especially of the young. And he pointed out, just right along the line that I mentioned, that that when the West, for whatever political reasons, encourages a strong Islamic front to either guarantee the supply of oil from the Middle East or to be a line of defense against the Soviet Union, that this has its consequences in the relationships of Muslims to Christians. Because historically Muslims have been tolerant of Christians. Tolerance is one of the tenets of the Islamic faith. Although historically they have never immediately granted a status to Christianity that would be exactly unequal with followers of the Islamic faith. But in some cases, historically this is true, in some cases the Christians were better off under Islamic rulers than they were under the previous Christian rulers, especially when they were the Byzantine rulers from Constantinople, and the alliance between the church and the state was so great that the ecclesiastical head was really not the leader, the main, the head leader of the church, but the empire, the emperor was. And especially for those Christians who didn't follow the Orthodox line, who departed from the seven ecumenical councils, especially the Chalcedon, life wasn't very good. The heresies were being rooted out, and the Orthodox Christian leaders, supported by the empire and the emperor, made life tough for the Copts in Egypt, for example. And so when the Muslims came in, they were relieved, and they, in some cases, even cooperated, because it brought them some relief, because Christians were not opposed to the use of force against other Christians back in those days to enforce an Orthodox line. But tolerance didn't always mean that everything was rosy. This Bishop Khoury of the Episcopal Church is of the opinion that the United States government is missing their objective with this kind of policy, attempting to strengthen the Islamic front and attempting to, by political alliances, to work its will in the Middle East. And his point of view, as a Palestinian, and as a Palestinian Christian, is simply this, and you've heard it again, but I think it's good to hear it from a Palestinian. Israel will always be an object of Arab rejection until the Palestinian question is resolved. That is his opinion, that Israel will always be an object of Arab rejection as long as until the Palestinian question is resolved. And it is his opinion that the U.S. could achieve all of its objectives, namely to guarantee the source of Arabian oil, keep the Soviet Union at a safe distance in the Middle East, and guarantee the existence of the Israeli state, all by supporting the Palestinian state, which they desire for their land. And the rest of it is all futile. Such is the opinion of Assisting Bishop Khoury in Amman. I thought that was interesting for you to hear his argument rather than mine. Now, I want to say something about the positive aspect to that question, the positive answer. How are Eastern Christians coping today in the strong Islamic culture? They're coping better. They're not doing so bad. What would be some of the factors here? What were some of the...
Women's lib.
Well, I don't remember if I exactly pointed that out. There certainly has been an improvement in the status of women in the Middle East. Well, they count for more than we often think they count for in Islam, but they have a certain division of labor there that they have not yielded much on. But they... Okay, exactly. We did. We talked about a renewed interest in each other on the part of the diverse Christian groups, even among those who are divided theologically. Continuing efforts to achieve Christian unity. And I mentioned the Middle East Council of Churches bringing together Protestants and Orthodox, the two families of the Orthodox Church. I also should tell you about... in the city of Jerusalem, for instance, I think it's each January, the week of prayer for Christian unity. And that, of course, is not just a matter of a couple of Protestant churches in a Midwestern town in the U.S. getting together with the ladies' aids. But there, the leaders of the Orthodox, Catholic, Protestant communions, many of them with representatives in Jerusalem, meet together and hold each day a worship in one of the churches of Jerusalem. And it was really fascinating for me to go to the one of the sites, the traditional sites of the Lord's Supper, and meet there with hundreds of Christians in a service of prayer and proclamation and music and silence as the whole Christ's prayer for unity was put in the everyday context of rubbing shoulders with one another in Jerusalem. Now, there is really no other city that reflects the divisions of Christianity quite like Jerusalem, but I was struck by the fact that I don't think in any of my experience I had been so impressed by the sincere desire for unity in that same city. Okay, that was one of the bright spots. Let's see, another. The fact that there's a Christian church at all in the Middle East has to be seen on the positive side. There certainly have been events in the history of that part of the world which could have meant the complete elimination, eradication of Christianity. But the fact is that they have survived. They are there, if not in the numbers that they once were, they certainly are not insignificant. And especially in Turkey, we have sensed the opposite, where the Christian community is dwindling very rapidly, less perhaps a tenth or a fifth of 1% of the population of Turkey, the site of two of the ancient patriarchs of the church. There's another answer to the question, how are Eastern Christians coping? Arab Christians today have an identity as Arabic-speaking Christians, and that is very definitely a plus. It was the fact that this did not happen in the early centuries of the church that it was very easy for Islam to take root in the Arabian Peninsula and in the Middle East, because the Christian gospel had not encountered the Arabic culture in an adequate way. And today, Arab Christians are sure of their identity as Arab Christians, and they are asking the West, okay, you would like to be of some assistance. Maybe not the way you think, but here's an idea. We need more Arabic literature. And in the broadcasting as well, there are ways that Christians in the West can be of assistance. They also are actively participating in Arab nationalism. Some Arab Christians would say Arab nationalism and the unity, the fragile unity that there is, in part has its origins among some Christian philosophers and politicians of earlier in this century and the last. And we noticed yesterday that even in the Greek Orthodox Church, after a long struggle, the Patriarch of Antioch, who now lives in Damascus, not in Antioch, is an Arab Christian, an Arabic-speaking Christian, rather than a Greek national. Patriarch Ignatius IV, the one who was invited by the Islamic heads of state in January of 1981 to come to Saudi Arabia, to the city of Taif, and address all the Islamic heads of states around the world on the question of the status of Jerusalem, the holy city. I just like to read you one quote from this book, Christians in the Arab East, by Robert Brenton Betts, who, and now I didn't lose my place, who talked about the new Arab Christian identity and their responsibility as citizens in the land. Sure, they're a minority, but they are reawakening to the fact that that doesn't mean that they have no voice at all in the affairs of their government and their state. And this Orthodox bishop, Bishop Adelby, says that Eastern Christians are abandoning this mentality of a minority church and are choosing a vocation which promises total immersion in the life of each of our individual countries. Then he goes on, confidence in the nation, total immersion in its destiny, fidelity and generosity in its service, frank and complete collaboration with our non-Christian citizens, adherence to an exemplary Christian life. This is the witness which we must render to Christ in the world of Islam. This is our first and most important mission. Just a tidbit of how the mentality has been transformed. I mentioned that throughout the histories, because of the laws of the land in an Islamic nation, Christians turned in upon themselves. They took on a defensive attitude, and they treasured so much the traditions because they felt that was the only way to preserve the faith, that they became a community within a community. And now they're beginning to see, I think, what is the biblical application of being the salt of the earth and the leaven in the society. So that is a bright spot, and I think it is perhaps the brightest on this question of how are they coping. They are not denying their responsibility as citizens and as Christians, and are speaking out where it is possible, and they are seeking to understand their responsibility to witness to Christ in new and creative ways that they had not used in the past. Well, we could go on and talk about sincere efforts on the part of the patriarchs and the bishops for spiritual revival in their communions and in their congregations. Especially in the Orthodox Church, we could talk about how the central role of liturgy, of worship, of the Eucharist, is the key to this spiritual revival, is the key to this new understanding of a witness to Christ in the society. You see, we take it very lightly, the privilege we have to worship and to gather together as a community. In many countries of the world where the Christian community is so small, it is the only public witness that they can bring without risking persecution or even their lives. Personal witness, I suppose, is always possible, but as far as a public witness is concerned, this worshiping community gathered around the promises of God in Jesus Christ and the sacraments has been a strength, a support, and a means of strength throughout the history, and they have not abandoned it. Recently, from the World Council of Churches Commission on World Mission and Evangelism, the director, Dr. Emilio Castro, reports on a question that he received that was asked to him by an American colleague. What has changed in his, or what was new in his understanding of evangelism? And he reports how very easily he was able to say, what is new in my understanding of evangelism is what I've learned from the Orthodox churches since I have been in this responsibility in Geneva with the World Council of Churches. And the very first lesson that he learned was, let's summarize it this way, the relationship between worship and evangelism, and how that central point in the Christian faith informs all efforts to reach out into the community. The very beauty of the worship they offer to God is a powerful attraction to people searching for roots, for truth, and for beauty. In many other parts of the world, we need to recover the richness of this Christian liturgical tradition. He goes on to point out how in Latin America, because this liturgical tradition had taken on a rather intellectual attitude, it had been put aside and to a certain extent neglected. But that this experience and contact that he's had with the Orthodox Christians have renewed his interest in this rich liturgical tradition and its relationship to the witness. We often couple it up this way: well, liturgy and worship, that's where we come together in order to go out. But the Orthodox tradition would say that's too shallow. It isn't only in order to go out, but in and of itself, it is our witness. The second thing that Emilio Castro mentioned that he learned from about evangelism from the Orthodox Church is what I mentioned yesterday about thinking of evangelism not only in geographical terms, but in generational terms. That is, passing the gospel to the future generations. And especially, I mentioned the role that the elderly have in this teaching ministry of the church, that the grandchildren are teaching, or the grandparents are teaching the grandchildren. And these were the two things that Dr. Emilio Castro said were new in his understanding of evangelism, and that he benefited greatly from his relationships with the Orthodox churches. Well, I think we have touched on several answers to the question of how are Eastern Christians doing, how are they coping, and how are they living their Christian faith in their context. Does anybody else want to add something to this, pick up on something I've said, ask a question about this first question before we move on to number two? Number two was, what are the prospects for peace and reconciliation in the Middle East? That one maybe hits us so hard that it's easy to say poor. As we studied the pieces of the mosaic, I suppose the deeper we plunge into the reality of the Middle East, the easier it is for us to say, are there any prospects? Well, I would hope that we continue to hope, and that we continue to work for peace, that the difficulties don't become such a burden that we throw up our hands and say we have no part to play. I really believe that the people of the area have the first responsibility. I think that's true, whether it be for giving a witness to the name of Christ or to the search for peace in the area. And I have seen their sincere desire for peace, and I have sensed that it is not true that hate rules. It is misunderstanding, mistrust. It is misinformation. It is the inability to do anything. But they have seen in that area 5 wars in the last 30 years. We seem to end, you know, for our personal involvement, except for the Korean conflict and Vietnam, you know, major wars, World War II, and then we haven't had anything like a world war. But we really had, if you would add up the conflicts around the world, we have had a great deal of war, and they have seen perhaps as much as anybody. I think that a solution to the problem of the Israeli and the Palestinians needs to have some help from the outside. I think we are involved there to such an extent that we cannot simply say, well, that's if they can't arrive at a solution, what are we going to be able to do? I think we have, by our support of Israel and our, whether it was our initial support or our continued support, we have put our finger in the pie. And maybe that lays a special responsibility on us. I think it calls us to a balanced policy, a foreign policy, concerning the Middle East question. Ron.
Well, did I understand you allude to the fact that the Christians generally in the area feel that we've been too strongly on the side of the Jews? And would they generally favor a policy that pushed more for a Palestinian homeland or something?
Yeah, they feel that our support of Israel has been our number one concern. They have seen, if not our negative votes, at least our abstentions on the UN Security Council when some of these questions come up. You know, the last time that it came down to a vote, we had usually had Great Britain and France with us, and we stood alone now. I don't know if that means that we will continue to stand alone, or if we will change our policy or what, but they have interpreted these votes at the level of the United Nations to mean that we favor Israel. On the other hand, we must confess there have been other efforts to keep a balance, and I would like to say that the role of the United States in the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty was a unique role that we often are not willing to play, where we have cost what it cost, we have tried to walk the narrow line. Now, the unfortunate thing is that we tried to keep a balance in a part of the conflict, and the Arabs said, well, that's not a solution. Where is there anything in that peace treaty that says about anything about the borders between Israel and Syria, or that tackles the Lebanese question? So they are, they, as I mentioned, they accuse the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty of being a piecemeal and of being impotent to really bring about peace. But I think it was a good experience for us to be an arbitrator, and I think President Carter will be remembered as having brought a lasting contribution to the whole idea of bringing balance into the situation. We are prone to see the issues in the light of the superpowers. I suppose you know that there is a strait of Hormuz in the Persian Gulf through which 30% of the world's petroleum passes. And we are as interested in seeing that that strait be open for the flow of oil as anybody is. And we have made it very clear to the world that we consider that a part of our strategic interest and national security. There is also the question of human rights. I think prospects for peace and reconciliation are not only to be thought of in terms of nation and nation. The example of Iran is a case in point. The Shah of Iran claimed ignorance of some of the tactics used by his secret police, and yet he never appeared to be called on the carpet by the United States, which was injecting a good deal of support to him, as to the tactics that were being used. And that all blew up in our faces one day when the Shah was eliminated, and when I think some very concrete examples of hatred spilled over, and our hostages were taken. We some people use the expression, we were held captive by this nation for all those many months. If we understand that reconciliation is not only a matter of nation and nation, but also within a nation, within groupings of people and governments and the governed, that we have a role to play. And in Latin America, where we talked about last week, we mentioned what a seemingly step backwards on our commitment to human rights really meant for many of the people in Central America. And that certainly would be true in the Middle East as well. I think the key there, and the answer to your question, is the phrase you used, the second-class citizens. I think they are not satisfied with that status. That is the status that within the nation of Israel that they have today. And those who live there, I think, are simply unhappy with that situation and would rally behind anybody, whether his name is Arafat or whatever, who would encourage them to stand up for what is rightfully theirs. I think the overwhelming majority of the Palestinian people will back the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Well, I think I'm referring to those who are not established in another country. We talked about the Palestinians immigrating to the far corners of the earth. And they will back the Palestinian cause too, but to a lesser extent. But the ones who are there, whether they be in the refugee camps, whether they be in their traditional family properties, in wherever they might be, because many of them still live on their own land, or whether they be in the neighboring countries, especially Lebanon and Jordan. No, they are outside the borders of Israel. None of them are inside the borders of Israel. They're in Lebanon and in Jordan, and I'm unclear. I really don't know if they're in Syria. That's the point. They aren't always accepted fully. We seem to lump, you know, Arabs together, but they certainly don't see it quite that way. The question of refugee camps is an interesting one. Some people claim that the refugee camps and the refugee mentality is being preserved intentionally by the Palestinian leaders. They don't want their people to leave the refugee camps, because once they leave the refugee camps and get their roots down in whatever countries they are, then the whole problem goes away. And so you put your finger on a very touchy spot. Well, they don't deny that they're keeping the pot boiling, but they say for a just cause, you see. They say for a just cause, you say for their own benefit, and that's where the difference comes. There are generations, the younger generation of Palestine, it's been how many years? 48, 34, 33 years. They know nothing else.
There are many, I suppose over half the population knows nothing other than the refugee camp. So that they are radical in that concern, that they need a solution and they need one today, shouldn't be surprising, you see.
It's generally agreed that two of the chief characteristics of the Arab people are that they are a proud people and that they are a sensitive people. And especially in an issue like this, their pride is at stake. They feel that if somebody else, for whatever reason, it was felt that they should have a homeland, why should their claim and their desire to have a homeland take second place? And they are very sensitive to, I would say, our tendency to see the problem in terms of our interests as Americans, if we're talking about U.S. foreign policy, rather than to understand it from, it's a little bit like the hermeneutical problem of having to, let's see if we can understand the problem as they understand it, because it's their problem, and thereby we'll understand our part and our side of it better as well. Well, as I mentioned, many of them have gone, and those who have gone have done very well. The Palestinians are a very intelligent people, and where they go, they soon end up in the best job. There's no question about it. But the the Southeast Asians and the Arabs are two different peoples, and it's also a question of understanding in that kind of a context what we would consider a terrible land, desert, and hard to make a living from, but it's their land, and the Arabs and the Jews have so many common roots, and you can see it in their understanding and concept of land. Our forefathers picked up and moved across the ocean and thought nothing of it. But I don't think the Norwegians were tied to the land like the Semitic people are tied to the land. Okay, when I talk about that, I guess I refer to the areas like the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And I think that my opinion that land is rightfully theirs, whether it be now a good thing to establish there a Palestinian state or to give them some kind of autonomy there. I don't want to speak to that, but I think they have a legitimate claim to that land. And I think that legitimate claim is there because of the history of the people there. The fact that they, since for over 1,500 generations, have lived on that land and suffered time and time again the invasions of colonial powers, whether they be neighboring Arab countries, or whether they be nations from the north, or whether they be the superpowers of the modern, of the present century. They simply have been pawns and been used as pawns by other people. And that goes against my grain just enough so that I'm willing to give them the benefit of the doubt. And I hope that we've only touched the tip of the iceberg, and that you'll continue to seek out opportunities to learn more about the Middle East and our Christian responsibility and our Christian ministry among the peoples of the Middle East. Thank you.